Guys, if you're in an area where you're trying to get to our classes, but we're not close to you, fret not. We actually have on-demand training at StreetCop.com. You can take that course online right now, and then you could attend that training in the future at no additional cost. You can redeem your voucher, so you get two for the price of one. We don't want to deny you the ability to take this training now, especially knowing that it can keep you safe, at a very minimum, putting bad guys in jail where they belong, and at the maximum, going home to your family. Check out StreetCop.com for that offer. 111-110.
Trying to be a street cop.
It's a pleasure to meet you, John.
It's good to meet you as well.
John, give us the, the 90-second to 128-second version of who you are. And if it takes longer than that, obviously the platform is yours. And, you know, I guess your upbringing from where you were from to your career in the military and then into what your, you know, intentions are now and what promotes you to or prompts you to show up and do the kind of work that you're doing.
Yeah. So I grew up in Manchester, New Hampshire, and I grew up in a blue collar city. I grew up in a blue collar family, and I had two grandfathers that were in World War II, one in the Army, one in the Navy. And I was sort of that kid that was fascinated by those stories of World War II. And I was also one of those kids that wanted to escape my hometown, the hometown where I was born, my parents were born, all four of my grandparents were born. So I was that kid that wanted to get out. And so those stories, those World War II stories kind of always fascinated with me. And then I sort of took on, I got really interested in submarine warfare and studying, you know, all of the exploits of the World War II submarine, you know, these captains and these crews that did these amazing things. And I just was always captivated by it. And then when I was in high school, Reagan was elected president and he was going to win the Cold War. That was the big thing. And we're going to defeat the evil empire back then. And there was an opportunity. Submarines were going to play a big part of that. And so I, at that point, realized that maybe my childhood dreams of maybe one day being on one of these submarines and the idea that we were needing them for this Cold War victory, that there was an opportunity. So I capitalized on that opportunity and did well in high school, went to an engineering school, and then ended up getting into the submarine program as an officer. And I spent 5 years on the USS Tennessee as a junior officer. Made 7 deployments during the end of the Cold War, saw the Cold War come to an end during my time. And it was just, you know, something that it was a childhood dream that I was able to actually do and fulfill. And, you know, and like a lot of people, I left the military after 5 years, went into corporate America. So I ended up working for 3 global companies for about 22 years. And what I did in those companies, I ran manufacturing plants. I ran 8 manufacturing plants. So in essence, when you run a manufacturing plant, it's sort of you're the captain of the ship. So I got a chance to kind of lead 8 different plants, manufacturing businesses. And then 6 years ago, I left corporate America, started my own manufacturing business called Peak Demand. And we make products for electric utilities. And I also started doing a lot more writing and talking and speaking on the issue of leadership. And mostly because I kind of realized that the experiences that I got in the military were rather unique. A lot of guys go in the military and they learn some leadership lessons, but submarine, being on board a submarine is a very unique environment. You can't pick your boss. You can't pick your employees. You can't pick your peers. And then you're locked in a metal tube for, 3 months at a time with these people, and you have to conduct very dangerous operations. And so there's a high level of qualification that's required, a high level of trust, and so these lessons I learned early on in my career as a submarine officer, I really took with me into manufacturing, and really it led to a lot of success throughout my career. But the basic lessons came from my time in the Navy. So I would say the last 6 years or so, I've been sort of talking about these things more. I've kind of come to the realization that these things are rather unique. So I've been writing about them and talking about them. I have a podcast called Deep Leadership, where I interview, military, business, leaders, community leaders, you know, and capture their best ideas. And then I've been writing books. I've got three books, all have been bestsellers around, you know, on leadership topics, basically. So, yeah.
When you joined the military and got into a sub, did you feel like the dream was fulfilled? You scratched that itch, per se?
Yeah, it's interesting when you get to a submarine, and that's what I thought. You know, like I thought I would get to the boats, and I'm suddenly in charge. But what you learn is that's just another hurdle. You have to spend the next year getting qualified. When you arrive to a submarine, you're considered what they call a nub, a non-useful body. You are breathing the air, you're stealing people's oxygen and food, and you're adding no value. So you have to go through a rigorous qualification process, which it takes about a year. So it took me a year, 6 months of that was underwater to fully qualify at every watch station. I had to know what every panel did, every hydraulic system. I had to qualify on every watch station and prove that I was fully capable to then be fully qualified as a submarine officer. So that took, it's a year long process. Then you get your gold dolphins, and you know, everybody's seen the SEAL trident pin, you know, that's kind of a familiar thing. Well, on the submariners were given what's known as a gold dolphins, and that's our qualification pin. And that signifies to the world that you're a qualified submarine officer. So it was at that point when I finally realized my childhood dream had been fulfilled, because that's really what I was after, is being, you know, fully qualified as a submarine officer. So, yeah. And it's funny because I was asked in a podcast once, like, what's your definition of success? And to me, it's working for years and years towards a goal and then taking that few minutes, that 5 minutes, 10 minutes, and just sitting back and relax and enjoy that moment. And that's, I remember I was down, we were doing torpedo shooting down in off the coast of the Bahamas. And I remember I had the watch and the mid watch, and we were on the surface, beautiful night in the Caribbean, you know, 75 degrees, every star in the world is out. And I was fully qualified as an officer. And that's the moment where I realized I had achieved my childhood dream. I was the officer of the deck of a nuclear submarine in the middle of the Caribbean. And the ship was mine, my responsibility. And that was the point where I realized I fully achieved my dream.
That's amazing, John. It's really cool to hear. What's life like on a submarine?
You know, I tell people it's like going into an office. And we had 155. And at that time, there was only guys. There was no women on submarines. Now there's women on submarines. But back then, it was 155 guys. Locked in the metal tube for, you know, 3 months at a time. And it's just like, it's like going to work and have your boss lock the doors and say, no one goes home for 3 months. And so it's a unique environment. It's almost like, you know, it's probably the closest thing to like space, being on the space station or being on a space mission, where you're locked in this, this metal tube. And what's interesting about it is that, you know, back then the Cold War, the Soviets were our enemy. So the enemy was out there. And so we had to be careful for that. But the other thing was, the real enemy was the amount of sea pressure that was surrounding the sub, that wanted to get in and crush the submarine like a tin can, send it to the bottom of the ocean. So we faced this constant enemy of the ocean, the seawater. And so there was this shared responsibility for operating the sub properly, but also a shared vulnerability. So if even the most junior sailor turned the wrong valve or did something wrong, we would all die. So that meant that we had to hold each other accountable to high levels of performance. We had to make sure that the junior people were trained, that the senior people trained the junior people, that the junior people were fully qualified before they took a watch station. So there was this shared vulnerability, which said that we need to make sure that everybody knows what the heck they're doing. It's interesting. The most junior sailor on the sub gets this the least favorite duty on the sub, and that is to shoot what we call shoot trash. And we have this thing called a TDU. It's a trash disposal unit. It's located on the bottom of the submarine. It's essentially a small torpedo tube where you load trash, you shut valves, and you launch it out the bottom of the submarine, right? It's a weighted, we put it in this weighted cylinder. And so that is actually a hole at the bottom of the submarine. And we give our most junior sailor that responsibility to open up a hole in the bottom of the submarine. And so you have to know that you can trust that sailor with your life. And so that level of shared responsibility, shared vulnerability meant, you know, and I wrote a book called All in the Same Boat. We were all in the same boat. We were all literally in the same boat. And if anything went wrong, we all would perish. It's not like a you know, an infantry troop where if you you get in combat with contact with the enemy, you might lose part of your team. This is if you get in contact with the enemy and you lose, everybody perishes. So it's a very unique all-in perspective that I took with me into the business world.
You guys ever hit anything?
No, but submarines do hit things. So, and there's stories of it. And so typically what you'll see is uncharted sea mountains are what they hit. So you're you're operating at high speed. Suddenly the ocean bottom comes up quickly and you hit, and there's a lot of stories of it. It's very dangerous, but we have really good charts, and we typically don't operate at high speeds near shallow depths. But one thing is interesting about this idea of hitting things is that if you do hit something, so the Navy likes to keep their boats in liquid, not solid, right? So if you do hit anything, so that's a buoy, a pier, another ship, an uncharted sea mountain, the captain loses their job. So as the commanding officer, even if he's not on the bridge or not in control room, he will lose his job if you come in contact with something other than ocean. And the reason being is that there's this high level of responsibility for the commanding officer. So you are responsible for that ship and that crew, and you're responsible for making sure that everyone under you is trained such that if you're not on duty, if you hit something, you're held accountable to that. So there's a high level. So one thing we used to say in the military is that you can delegate authority, but you can never delegate responsibility. As a senior officer, you are responsible for the people underneath you. And so you can delegate them a task or an action and give them the authority to do that. But you always hold on to that responsibility. The captain always was responsible for everything that happened on that boat.
I, not too long ago, watched a video that I probably watched years earlier. And it was, I'm sure you're familiar with Simon Sinek.
Yeah.
And it was Simon Sinek. It's about an hour and 37 minutes. It's actually a very good leadership program or speech that he gave at Microsoft that brought him in. He talks about a Navy commander. Mm-hmm. And what he talks about, and I don't know the guy's name, he says he took the worst fleet or the worst crew in the fleet of submarines and changed it from the worst to the best in the history of the U.S. Hmm. Simply by empowering people. And he said the biggest shift was he stopped requiring people to say request permission and had them start saying, I intend to.
Hmm. Interesting. Yeah.
Thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think empowerment is a big deal. And I think it goes right back to what I was saying before. You know, when we as leaders, right, always maintain responsibility for our business or our whatever we're in charge of, you know, whether it's a police station, whether it's a fire station, whether it's a nonprofit, right? We are responsible for that business, right? But we empower the people that work for us. We delegate authority. So we give them the full authority to get a certain task done. We give them, so they don't have to come to ask us for permission. That's a big part of delegating authority. But if something goes wrong, we're there to back them up, right? And so I think that's a really, and so one of the things that I noticed in corporate America when I first got there is we do just the opposite. So we delegate responsibility and we maintain authority. So these, you know, what I would say bad bosses, they say, you got to come to me for everything. You got to come to me for permission. So we don't give them the authority to do their job. We want to hold everything tight to the vest, right? But then if something goes wrong, we hold them responsible for the problem. And so, you know, we throw them under the bus when anything goes wrong. So we invert those things, I noticed in corporate America. And so we, these bad bosses essentially will hold people responsible, but they don't give them the full authority to get the job done. And so one of the things is what Simon Sinek is talking about, and I agree with him, is that when you do delegate and when you give people authority, and you give them all the right authority to get the job done, they own the process and they know that they own it. But then having a boss that's going to back them up if something goes wrong, that's true empowerment.
How do you prove to them that when you do let them off the leash, they should feel comfortable to make a mistake?
Well, it's always by action, right? So how do you respond to when failure occurs, right? How do you deal with failure? You know, I tell the story when I speak at universities a lot, usually to graduate students about leadership, and people kind of, they're going to be going into business as leaders. And I get a chance to talk to them. And one of the things is I tell a story about I had a boss that when I first started my career out of the military, I was actually a design engineer. We were designing a product that, you know, never been done before. It was first of its kind. It's a long story. I won't go into it, but a lot of visibility, a lot of money being spent. And the first time we went to the test lab, the gear blew up. It completely failed the test. And I had to call my boss. And at that time, I was new to this industry, and I thought, well, I'm probably going to lose my job. But that boss provided what I would say the best example of what we should do as leaders, is that he backed me up when something went wrong. He realized I was doing something that was very difficult, never been done before, and you know, there was bound to be some problems doing what we're trying to do. When I called him and told him we failed the test, the first thing he said was, do you know what happened? And I said, yes. He said, can you fix it? I said, yes. And he said, we'll get back here. Let's get it fixed and let's get back to the test lab. And we ended up doing that. And we ended up being the first in the industry for this type of product, and then made the company millions. We highly recognized, we got a lot of publicity for the company. It became the gold standard for product in the industry. And it was all because one boss had my back when something went wrong. And I think we need to be able to do that as bosses. We need to back up our people and by our actions, not our words.
What do you think causes or is causing the lack of good leadership? And on top of that, do you think we're progressing more into an era of leadership improving?
It's two questions, really. One being, is it getting better? And I would say, according to Gallup, no. It's generally, 70% of employees are disengaged at work, and that number hasn't changed much. I think there's more and more awareness of leadership issues, but it's still if you're just measuring the total employee engagement, it hasn't changed too much in the past 10, 15 years. That being said, one of the major challenges with leadership is that we tend to, and it's different in every industry, but my observation, especially in corporate America, we tend to promote people not based on their leadership skills, but how they do as an individual contributor. So, for example, you're a really good engineer. You're the best engineer we have. You're our top engineer. We're going to make you engineering manager. Well, the skills required to lead an engineering department are completely different than those required to be the best engineer in the department. And so we might take that individual and maybe put them through, make them read a book, or maybe send them to a small course on leadership. But we really never give them a chance to hone and craft those leadership skills. So leadership skills are just like any other skills. You have to learn them, and you have to practice them to get better at them. And I think we don't take that kind of approach to leadership. We just promote people. You're the engineering manager right now. We call people managers. We don't necessarily call them leaders. And the studies have shown that typically there's a 10-year gap between when somebody gets promoted into a leadership position and when they truly get high quality, detailed, deep training in leadership. There's about a 10-year gap. So we typically promote people and we say trial and error, figure it out. And so people try to figure it out. And a lot of people who are really good as individual contributors, they'll go back to what they're comfortable with. So like the example of an engineering manager, he's really good at doing engineering drawings. So he might shut his door and work on engineering drawings where his comfort zone is. But where he needs to be is out with his people, talking with his team, finding out where the challenges are, what they need to do. So again, it's a whole different set of skills. And we don't appreciate that typically in companies, that is, being a leader requires a whole different set of skills that are not the same skills that got you to the position right before you became a manager. They're a different set of skills. And we don't take that for granted. I mean, I think the best leadership training is done in almost a mentor-mentee relationship. And that's the way the military did it. So you had somebody above you, a little more senior, and probably I would imagine the police operate in a very similar manner, where you have someone more senior to you that you mentor under until you're able to stand on your own. And we don't do that in most companies. We just throw you in, we throw you to the wolves, you figure it out, and we let people go. And we don't truly promote based on leadership skills. We promote based on, your performance, your history, your education, or what have you, but it's not leadership based.
What I'm hearing you saying is recognizing that when you move to a leadership position, it's a different job with a different set of skills and mm-hmm. it's a different set of tasks.
Yeah, completely. It really is. It's a completely different job. And I think those that are really successful at leadership recognize that. They make that shift. And I think what I liked about the military is that over time, right, you start off as an individual contributor, and then it's almost like, and you don't much do much leading. And as you get to the next rank, you maybe have a little bit of leadership, but you still have a lot of individual contributor. And as you grow in your responsibility, you get more and more leadership tasks and less about actual physical activity that you do, you know, actions that you do, individual contributions. So it you grow over time. And I don't think we allow people to grow over time to that leadership position. So give them a chance to run a small team or a small project first before they become, you know, a department head or run a whole facility or what have you. So I used to see a lot of times guys get moved into management positions that had no leadership training, no leadership experience, and they struggled because you know, leadership is difficult. People are difficult. I always say people are messy, right? And you know, they don't do what you think they're going to do, right? And they react randomly to your message. And I think I see a lot of people get frustrated with the whole people side of leadership. And but that's really, you know, I say in my books that leadership is a people business, and you've got to really embrace and love people if you want to be in a role where you're a leader.
How important is EQ, and people who are listening, emotional quotient, in a leadership role where you can separate your emotions from good judgment?
Yeah, it's vital. I mean, it's essential. And it's there a piece of this that's really interesting is the idea of empathy. You know, I think that the best bosses out there, the best leaders, have a little bit of this ability to recognize what their people are going through, and to be able to direct the activities based on each of the various individuals in their team. They're able to be empathetic towards the needs of that each individual. You know, like a parent, right? I raised two boys. Both my boys were very different, so they both needed different guidance to be able to get to where they are today. And our employees are that way too. We can't take a generic approach to leadership. Everybody is facing all sorts of different challenges in their life. They have all different experiences. They all have different biases. They have different backgrounds. They have some maybe have worked for great leaders their whole life. Maybe they've always had bad bosses. So everybody has a different approach. And I think being the high level of EQ is somebody that can be able to know how to lead each individual to bring out the best of that individual for the team and for that individual themselves.
I hear it over and over again, and what you're saying is that we promote people but never train them for the new position. We just expect things from them. You know, I constantly explain, and I don't want to say argue because I don't think I'm arguing it, that you literally, if you take this position of leadership and you take it seriously and you're excited that it's you because you have good intention, you can go to YouTube and literally binge watch for a couple of days significant amounts of leadership thoughts on how to behave and mold how you're going to be received by your people, you know, with selflessness and some self-care and all those things, those magical formula that does make good leadership. You don't have to figure it out yourself. The road has been paved. Mm. The decision you have to make is whether you seek to find that road. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, it's a really good point that you bring up. And I really, that's one of the struggles that I've felt since I've been writing and talking about leadership is that, you have to recognize that you need to learn or you need to develop to be able to go out and seek out, like I said, YouTube or read books or what have you. And one of the things I've noticed is that the people that read my books, the people that follow my podcast, the people that interact with me on social media are great bosses already. They're great leaders already, and they're trying to get better. My struggle is getting the people that are bad bosses to actually, you know, be self-aware enough that they need help and they need to go and read books and engage in videos and try to develop their leadership techniques better. So it's really interesting. What I've noticed is the people that are really trying to learn and trying to get better are actually the great leaders already, you know? And so to me, it's like the sick need the doctor. How do we reach are seeking out the doctor. How do we get to the sick that need the doctor? And I think that's been probably the thing I've struggled with, different ways to be able to get the message to the people that need it the most. And that's been, you know, as a leadership author and speaker, how do I get that message to those people that really need the help?
I think human psychology plays a major role in the position that you're going to take in this world. Whether it's your predisposition of genetics and the brain that you have, and in addition to the life that you've lived and encountered and sustained, whatever you, however you want to describe it. You know, we have a guy at this company, does a phenomenal leadership program. And there is times when somebody will say to him, well, the world does need ditch diggers. You know, and the thought for us who are so caring about trying to change and move it, and I'll include you in on it. And that same fight, you know, it's hard to often not get jaded as you progress and try to push what you see as obvious solutions to some significant issues. Clearly, through your biography and the life that you've lived, you are somebody who knows how to fix things. You are solution-based. If your therapist hasn't told you this yet, I'm sure they're going to at one point in your life, you're a fixer.
Yes.
Right? Which is good and bad. There's some detriment to being a fixer as well.
Yeah.
Believe me, I'm a fixer. you know, I think guys like you and I are trying to constantly wrap our heads around how do we get to where we need to get to. But I want to just remind everybody to not lose sight of who's already here and making sure that we're comforting those people and giving them what they deserve rather than focusing on those people that we just can't reach. Sometimes, maybe I'll change my position on this later on. We just have to know there's some battles we're not going
to
win.
Very true. When I speak to reaching the people that need to be reached, it's more the leaders or the people that have been promoted to management that are doing a crappy job. The stories I hear are bad. We all hear it. I mean, you know, just in your social life, listen to the stories of bad bosses. I was having a drink with a friend of my wife's a couple weeks ago. She's a teacher and she's near retirement. And she said to me, in all my years of education, I've had one principal that was a good leader. Mm-hmm. Now, how does somebody do a career of 40 years and have one leader that was good? So all her other leaders, that's who I'm talking about. The people that are bad leaders, those are the ones I'm frustrated with. I think you said something that was interesting. You said the world needs dig ditchers. And I would say this is a lot of what I do is that maybe because I came from a blue collar background, I have respect for the people that are in my factory right now. I have tremendous respect. They are the ones adding value to the product, right? If you take it to the police force, the people on the one that's walking the streets, you know, that's got the beat cop, they're the ones that are adding the value right there. They're doing the community policing right there. Same thing. So I've always had this idea is how can I be the best boss for the people that are doing the work? Right? Because I sit in an office, in an air-conditioned office with a computer, and that's kind of my life, right? They're out there in the conditions. It could be hot one day. It could be very busy. You know, their back is sore. They've been standing on concrete. How do we make their lives easier so they could be more successful? And I think more leaders need to have understanding that the people that are actually adding value to your business are the most important people, not the person in the corner office, not the person with the title. And I think that when you come to that realization that your job is to make the job of everyone that works for you easier, then that's a different approach to leadership. So I would say for those people that were born to dig ditches and love being, you know, doing blue collar work, and I want to make sure that they have a boss that's going to have their back and it's going to help them, you know, make the right decisions for that business or that entity to be successful. And I think that's where I'm out for, is looking out for the guy that's actually doing the work.
What I'm hearing you say is that it takes conscious effort and discipline coupled with intent to be a good leader.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
But imagine intent is probably the forefront of it. That's the most important aspect, is the intention to begin with, to lead well and to serve your people well.
Yeah, there's a quote from Lisa Hayesha I include in my books, and it says, you know, people do the right thing, choose leadership to make a difference. They want to become a leader because they want to make a difference in the organization. If that's your intention, is you want to make a difference, you want to make things better for the people that are working for you, then that's the right intention. You know, I say also in my books that, you know, when you're a leader, you have the watch. You know, we were, you know, on a submarine, when we took over, we stood 6-hour watches. So when you had the watch, you were responsible for both the mission and the people. And we forget that little and sometimes in leadership. We take care of the mission first. Oh, we got to make money, right? We got to make money in business. And so we make decisions that are detrimental to our people to be able to make profits. And when you are the boss, when you're the leader, you are responsible for the mission and the people. And when you take that approach, then I think you have a different mindset when it comes to dealing with your team.
What do you say to a leader who did his or her best but failed?
Well, failure is great. I mean, failure is the most powerful teaching tool we have. So, I would say in the military, one of the things they did to us on the submarine is they gave us these, what we call under instruction watches. So you were the junior officer of the deck. You had someone above you. And the officer deck would purposely give you scenarios where there's no way you can succeed. So they would be drills where everything would go wrong, and they wanted you to try to figure out the best way to come out of that drill set, right? And typically you failed, and failure is a powerful teaching tool. So you come away with like, oh, I don't want that to ever happen again. So you spend time learning how do I not let that happen again. So you spend time developing yourself as a leader when you do fail. So when it comes to failure in leadership, that's probably the best time you get a chance to take that next step up in your journey as a leader, is because you made a mistake, you screwed up, and you get a chance to sit back and reassess and relearn, and deal, if you've got a mentor or a boss or someone that's willing to help guide you through that process, you're going to be a better leader on the other side of making a mistake.
How does one cope with a bad leader? What are options for somebody who's working under a bad leader?
It's hard. I mean, to be honest, I've had bad bosses. I've had, I've had micromanagers. I've had yellers. I've had screamers. I've had all sorts of different kind of bosses over my career. And I think one of the things I like to talk about is the idea that, you can provide feedback, right? So, and I always say in private, is having that discussion with a boss, saying, hey, this is what you asked me to do. This is what it made me feel like. This is my concern, being in this working relationship. You can have those discussions one-on-one with your boss. And I've had those discussions one-on-one, but it doesn't mean that your boss is likely going to change, or he's going to be different, or she's going to be different. But I do believe that you have to take the opportunity to express how you feel to your boss. And if you see the boss is unwilling, or it's just not going to change, they're the way they are, that's the way they're going to be, then I think that I really do encourage people to go where you're celebrated, not where you're tolerated. So go where you're going to be appreciated, where your skills are going to be appreciated. You might have a bad boss, and you may have to leave and go somewhere else. But do take the opportunity to have that discussion with your boss. Do it in private. Because they may not be self-aware. I mean, a lot of bosses are not self-aware of how they say things. I have many employees have come to me and said, you said this in a meeting. This is the way I felt. And wow, it just hits me in the chest. I didn't realize that you felt that way because of what I said. I'll give you an example. You heard the expression praise in public and criticize in private or correct in private. Well, that's the way I always was. And I would have these all employee meetings, and I would say, hey, Bob, he worked over and did this big project here. I want to thank you, and everybody applauds and stuff like that. And I had an employee come to me after one of these all employee meetings, and I say, you talked about Bob doing all what he did, but I was there the whole time with him, and you didn't even mention me at all. And that kind of sucked. So instead of doing something I thought was good for, for an employee, I actually would, I hurt another employee's feelings through that. And it's actually why I've changed now, when I actually praise in private. So, actually we'll hand write a letter and send it to an employee's house and let them read it with their family. And it's less embarrassing. Oh, I've also had employees say it's embarrassing to be called out in a meeting or what have you. So again, when you get that feedback as a boss, it gives you a chance to self-correct and actually work on things you weren't even aware you were doing. So that's why I say it's important to talk to your boss, have that conversation. If you are working for a bad boss, and there's a lot of bosses out there that are bad. So
law enforcement officers will probably voice their chief complaint of what's wrong with the job pretty much is contained within four walls of a police department.
Yeah.
The outside job in the public is not the most taxing thing about being a cop, albeit the most physically dangerous for sure. But the mental danger lies within the walls of the police department. This is no secret. And I'm sure that it's not the only profession that succumbs to something as similar as that. I often tell people that if you're going to enter into this career, which has a lot of outside forces that can be mentally taxing, you need to make an evaluation of where you work. What's the outlook look like? Is it going to continue? Is there hope of change? And may have to do some uncomfortable shit and leave and find a place, like you just said, that appreciates who you are and the kind of effort that you have. Are you surprised to hear that I think a far majority of police, that is their chief complaint of what's wrong with the job, is the bad leadership or poor administrations?
Oh, no, I'm not surprised at all. My wife is a teacher, and she'll tell you her joy is teaching children, right? Her pain is everything else. Mm-hmm. So everything around, you know, the job of teaching, she loves. She was born to do it, right? She has that. That's what she was meant to do. But it's all the bureaucracy and rules and bad decisions from management that frustrates her to no end. And that's why a lot of teachers are leaving the profession and going finding other jobs, because it's not the classroom work. Just like you said, it's not doing the job of policing that's the problem. It's everything in the back office. And shame on us as leaders by creating a world where the bureaucracy and the poor decisions frustrate our best people. We should be empowering our best people, right? We should be supporting our best people to do their job. And I tell you, my wife has had some amazing leaders in that principal position. And when you have those bosses that step up and care deeply about the people on the front lines, it makes the job so much better for the people on the front lines. And she will tell you, she remembers fondly every single principal that she had that cared for the teacher. It was a teacher focused principal. You know, you hear about a leader in the Navy. He was a sailor's, you know, he was a sailor's officer. He took care of the men, you know. And I think, you know, when you find a leader that takes care of the people on the front line, that's when they really make a difference. And that's what I've tried to do in my career, is take care of the people on the front line. And I think it's frustrating when I hear what you say about policing, because I know that's the same thing my wife has dealt with in her career.
You know, actually, it's so interesting. There's almost kind of I imagine that it's difficult for police leaders who are good to try to get out of the spotlight of automatically being judged because that they're essentially bad. You know, typically in law enforcement, when somebody is in a high ranking position, we tend to distrust them immediately because of our experience.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I will say, on behalf of the great chiefs and captains and all the people in leadership positions, there are some wonderful people, and they are trying to get out of the way of being labeled into that category. They're actually proactively embarrassed by it, where they almost have to explain themselves of who they are when engaged in a conversation to remove them from the judgment or the label or the feeling that you get when you hear that somebody is this person. And those people tend to gravitate towards. It's interesting that you will have people who have a good reputation of being a good leader and has the support of the rank and file and vice versa. And how many people will be looking to go work for that person? And you have another agency here, Allegan State, New Jersey, that is typically known for hacking people's heads off. On every single mistake that you make, you are getting suspended. Mm-hmm. And you have people leaving that agency going to far less, what you would imagine in the scale of pay and environment, significantly worse conditions to avoid these quote unquote better conditions, but with this internal hangman's noose to say, yeah. Like it's actually been rumored that they will have interview processes and nobody will show up. Yeah. And they're not a low paying agency. They're not in a bad area. Their reputation of being so toxic.
Yep.
Scares the britches off of people who are desperate to get into law enforcement, but still will not take a position at that agency. It's wild.
It's funny. I say that, you know, it takes $0 to treat someone with respect, to treat people with respect. Yet when you don't, it costs you a fortune. And think about that. You're talking about that agency. One is they struggle to get people, right? Two, they struggle with turnover. Three, they have morale issues, and I'm sure the performance of the rank and file isn't the highest when you're in an environment like that, because when you're afraid for your career, right? When you're operating in a defensive position, you don't rock the boat. You play everything by the book and you go home. You punch your time card and you go home, and you don't want to ruffle any feathers. And in a business like mine, you're dead. If your employees are not striving to do things that have never been done before and taking chances and trying to get better, you're going to fail as a business. And I'm an entrepreneur. So I started this business 6 years ago. I've got to be cutting edge, try to figure out new and better ways of doing things. I'm dead if I don't do that. But that means I got to give my people the chance to fail and not cut their heads off if we do make a mistake through the process. So when you're in a position like that, when you're afraid to make decisions, you're afraid to change, you're afraid to do anything because you're fear for your job, you're dead in my industry and that's the truth.
Do you think there's a difference between, and I'm going to actually separate three categories here, and I think you'll probably understand why I'm doing this. Private industry, public industry, and you say entrepreneurship, we can call it a startup. That's what I have in my notes, and a startup. So let's call those three categories. Yeah. Why do you think they're different when it comes to leadership, and how do they differ?
Well, certainly the public is
the most terrifying. I will agree.
It is, because you've got a, how do I say, you've got way too much bureaucracy in that's required. So whether it's, you know, in policing or fire or just back office, government, local government agencies, whatever. It's the people that are making the rules. They just keep making rules. There's no end in sight. So there's a lot of bureaucracy, and everything has to be followed. And it's not in favor of the people that are actually getting the job done, right? So you end up like my wife. She ends up doing reporting, like spending all this time writing reports about kids that it's not really going to help them. But it's to feed the bureaucracy that's required that certain reports get filed and what have you. Now, when you come to big companies, you get this thing where it's a command and control thing. So we want the company to get to this level to do this. You have to do this. You have to do this. You have to do this. And so we want leaders, bosses, if you will, managers to manage and not go outside. Don't color outside the lines. We have to. Your role in the puzzle is to do this, and yours is this, and what have you. And so there's this command and control aspect. It's maybe less bureaucracy, but more is everybody has to operate a certain way. When you get into the world of startups and entrepreneurship, if you will, it's fun because that stuff doesn't you don't care about that stuff. There's no bureaucracy, and there's no top down control. It's everyone working towards a common purpose. It's more like a family than it is a business. And, that's what I enjoy. I enjoy that aspect of it. One of the things you mentioned was this us and them. So one of the things that you mentioned in law enforcement, it's the people, there's resentment just because of your position, right? It's an us and them, facing. And when I started my career in manufacturing, I was an engineer, and we were required to wear a tie every day to work. And so whenever we went out on the shop floor to talk to the employees, they saw us wearing a tie. And they actually had a nick. They used to call us the tie. Oh, one of the ties is here. So we were them, and they were us. And we were separated. It's one of the things I've always done in my career is I don't dress up. I wear jeans and boots. And when I go out on the shop floor, I look like everybody else, right? I'm not any different than you. We're both important to this business. We just have different jobs to do. And I think that's a different approach from this us and them. And I love that part about being an entrepreneur.
This leads me to my next question. is how do you prefer working for someone else to now working for yourself? And what prompted that change? And maybe a little redundant to your last response, but maybe maybe more of a micro answer to that, or maybe macro.
For me, at least, the most fun I ever had in my corporate career was I was given the responsibility to run a manufacturing plant with 140 people. And at that time, the company I was working for was very decentralized and didn't have a very large corporate staff. So they basically said, we trust you as a general manager, run the business as best you can, send the money to corporate. And very little rules, very little control, you know, direct control over our business. And I had a blast. I had a blast running that business. We doubled profits. We grew at levels that had never been grown before. And we had a lot of fun doing it. But that same company over the years and years and years, they became very top heavy. So more and more layers of management, more and more people telling you how to do things, more and more restrictions. Your degrees of freedom as a general manager was shrinking every year I was there, to the point where I couldn't even give pay raises. So that had to be approved every single, I couldn't hire, I couldn't fire, I couldn't give pay raise, I couldn't do anything without someone above me approving it. So I lost those degrees of freedom that made me successful. So I said, I need to leave this one company. And I went to another global company and it was worse. So at that point I went, well, maybe I just need to start my own business. And that's what I did. So I was responsible, but I wasn't given the authority to get my job done, as we talked about earlier. And my authority kept shrinking, but my responsibility, people were getting fired for not making their numbers, but they were given no control to make the decisions to be able to impact the performance of their business. And when that happens, when you give people no authority, but hold a high level of responsibility, you get frustration. I was frustrated as a leader. So that's why I decided to go off on my own.
Scary to be on your own at times, huh?
Oh, there's no safety net. I mean, anyone
else. That's the beauty of it though, right? Because there's also no cap. There's no glass ceiling.
There is nothing. Yeah. You're all on your own. It's a blank sheet of paper. You live, eat and breathe by your performance. And I love it and I hate it. So I do love it, but there's days when I'm looking at the numbers and I'm like, okay, how am I going to get through payroll this month, right? Or how am I going to get through this week? I'm waiting for a check from a customer. What am I going to do? You know, so it's all you and I love it, but it's definitely the hardest thing I've ever done.
I would say it's worth it though.
No, it is. Yeah, 100%.
And I just want to caution people who are listening to this to think that that's an option for them. I would highly warn against people trying to get into business without the understanding that this thing will take over your life completely and you must be obsessed with it. And if you are not somebody who gets a real fill and a rise and considers work to be your hobby where you're the most happy and enjoyable, stay at your fucking job.
Yes.
Because this is what it takes.
Yeah.
This summer, I am literally looking down the pipe of a 1 week hiatus. One of those days I'm actually working, teaching somewhere. And I have to contemplate, is that even in the cards for me? And people look at our business and say, oh, this guy must be so successful that yeah, there's success here. There's no question about it, right? We're a big agency. We provide law enforcement training at a substantial amount, maybe even the biggest in the country. That's very possible without sounding overzealous. But the reality is I don't get to do what you guys do. And I think people get a real romantic idea that I'm going to open a business. Somebody said to me recently, they go, well, people I know that own businesses seem to be wealthy. I go, that's because their businesses worked.
Right. Well,
the other 94% of people that open businesses that are fucking broke.
That's exactly right.
Would you rather have a job that pays you 75 grand or a business that pays you 20? Because that's real. And if you don't know, boy, you should ask your friends. Do you think I'm somebody who has good common sense or quote unquote uncommon sense? Do you think I'm somebody who knows how to resolve issues and improve things? And if the answer is no, and you really acknowledge that you're not following or tracking at an intelligence level that most other people are, keep your job. And I'm saying that as a friend, because I have watched it and I've seen it. And if you think Shark Tank really gets your juices flowing and that's going to be you, you are going to be sadly mistaken. I can assure you that. Also, on the other side note, take what I've said. If you are somebody who is hearing these voices and knows that this person and that things saying to you inside, you can do more. you know that you can, you know, what's holding you back? You know, are you worried? Are you letting fear dictate your decisions? Jump and grow your wings on the way down. Not everything has to be calculated. There has to be, you know, procrastination, or what is it called? Analysis paralysis, right?
Yeah.
You're just constantly calculating. That's really not the formula for a good, successful jump. And if anybody is looking to go down the route of entrepreneurship, know that it doesn't just end in the office. You're going to have to trade in everything that you love to constantly be able to grow and progress. For example, I coach some people a little bit here and there. And I'm like, what do you listen to on the way to work? And they're like, oh, I listen to music. I'm like, that's cool. That's over. So here's 5 audio books. You want to be successful, right? That's what you want to know what I did. And well, I don't know if I like audiobooks. I had somebody tell me 6-7 weeks ago at my house. Well, I can't listen to audiobooks when I work out like you do. I just can't retain all that information. I said, you don't have to. You only got to retain 50% of it. It's still a win. How about 10% of it? Better than listening to fucking rock music because you get pumped and you get a better workout in. And that's the kind of discipline that you must employ when you're talking about going down the path of entrepreneurship. We had a girl yesterday who said, she asked, why are your classes so expensive? And first of all, let me just address that they're not.
Yeah.
Number two, I gave a very, very well-rounded explanation of why we have to make money. And it just proves the point that everybody sees the success, but nobody sees the journey.
Yeah.
You're happy with the decision you made there? Let me ask you this. Stemming off that last question, what are some things that you're doing to progress your education as an entrepreneur and a thought leader in leadership?
Yeah, I say that, you know, leaders should always be learning, you know, and I think that if you're humble enough and you realize that you don't know everything, and I'm 55 and I'm still learning things every day.
You look fucking great for 55. Hey, I don't have a filter on or something.
No filters. No,
holy shit. Okay. So before we go on.
Yeah.
Tell me what's the deal. Actually, matter of fact, you would shave that goatee and get the gray off. You'd probably look even younger.
Yeah, I know. Probably.
What's the secret?
I don't know. I get up at 4 a.m. every day. I spend the first part of my day writing. So I'm either writing blog posts or working on next book or whatever. Then I spent the next hour working out. So I have a weight room at the house. And then, yeah, there you go. Gun show. So, and then... I then get ready to go to work. But on the way to work, I'm either listening. It's funny you said that. It's called Dashboard University. What are you doing? I have a 40-minute commute. What are you doing that 40 minutes to get better? Right. So I spend time listening to audiobooks and listen to podcasts, some of my favorite podcasts, and trying to get
better. What's your favorite podcast? Let me ask that. Give me your top 3 favorite ones. We have to overlap at some point, I'd imagine.
Yeah, so I don't tend to listen to the mainstream big maybe some of the big shows, other than I do listen to Joe Rogan, only because he brings on some fascinating people with an interesting take on things, and I'm always fascinated by his curiosity towards the world, right? So I do listen to him.
Well, let's go even a little more niche, but maybe a little more bigger in that niche market. We're both obviously in business development. Maybe this is even me being a little selfish right now to see if I can get a little bromance going here. You know what I mean? This is like two little giddy squirrels that met next to a fucking tree. You know what I mean?
Right. So one show I like and I've become friends with is called The Coach Bruce Show. And he's a former lacrosse coach that he's more giving you a lot of business advice, how to separate yourself from the pack, how to market yourself, or not so much market, but represent yourself in a unique way. He's always looking at the world slightly different, like looking for those people that have broken through with some interesting ideas. And he's always got examples from country music or from a small business or from a college, like a small college coach will do something that gets them attention. So it's the idea of, how do you separate yourself from the pack through innovative ways without spending a lot of money as an entrepreneur? So how do you elevate your brand by doing some almost like guerrilla marketing, if you will? So he's kind of a neat guy to listen to. So he's one of the shows that I'm just listening to last night going home from work. So, but he's kind of a unique show. And this one's a kind of a funny one. You'll laugh at this one. I got a friend who's a former submarine guy like myself, and he has a podcast called the Starfleet Leadership Academy. And it's the dumbest idea for a podcast, but I can't stop listening because it's so well produced. But he basically watches an episode of Star Trek and he breaks down all the leadership lessons from that episode. And it's cool. It's super entertaining. And it's you get really good lessons without actually feeling like you're being lectured at. It's just sort of entertaining and informative. So kind of a unique show that he puts out. And that's one of the ones I always have on there and we listen to. But
what about books? Give me your one or top three favorite books that you think have been the most impactful in your life for you. And it could be, yeah, you want to talk business, which I shouldn't make it that about that because it's selfish of me, because I'm looking for that common ground, but three books that you, and they could be the most general books you want, maybe something that everybody's familiar with.
Yeah. First, Break All the Rules. Marcus Buckingham was the one that opened my eyes up to what leaders need to be or could be. So that book was written, Marcus was with the Gallup organization when he wrote it. That's the one that probably had the greatest impact in my life. And that's when I give to new leaders. Whenever they're getting promoted, I give them that book to read. Jim Collins, Good to Great, but in Good to Great, which is a great book, he brings up what's called a level five leader. And so he focuses on who are the leaders that led these big companies to become super successful and to beat market averages and what have you. And what he found was there was this certain style of leader that had, it was a high level of will, and then this high level of fierce resolve, but also high level of humility. And it's this humility and fierce resolve is that creates this, what he calls a level five leader. So Jim Collins, Good to Great. And then I would say Angela Duckworth, Grit. It's the one thing I look for when I'm hiring employees is show me where you've overcome difficulties in your life. And so I would say my success in my career has always been about overcoming difficulties and overcoming challenges. And so I look for people who have grit. Typically, I hire a lot of military veterans, combat veterans. I want somebody that shows that has been through the ringer, has come out the other side a better person for it. So I really like that book by Angela Duckworth called Grit.
Yep, I'm familiar with some of these books. I have read Good to Great, might have a slight addiction to education. Obviously, I run an education company, and yes, I just know the value and importance of actually being educated to go forward and perform something. Man, I had fun. Is there anything we missed today? Because I thought it was good.
No, I had a lot of fun as well, too. Yeah, no, I think it's great to connect with you and to learn about what you're doing. And it's great to see, you know, you bringing that that passion towards leadership to this law enforcement community. It's good to see that.
I also accept physical compliments if there's anything you noticed about me that you like.
Well, you're jacked. What am I going to say?
Dude, I appreciate it. That's exactly what I was looking for, bro. That's it. So you hit the nail on the head there.
Right.
Listen, this was wonderful. John, promote whatever you want to promote. Where can they find you? What's the books?
Yeah. So I've got a new book out called You Have the Watch. And what this is actually a workbook. It'll take you through an entire year of leadership training. So it's designed to be on your desk. So in the book, there's 50 themes, and each day you reflect on a different facet of that theme. And it's actually interactive. So do this thing, come back, how'd it go? What'd you learn from it? So that's the book that's up here called You Have the Watch. And it's a guided journal for leaders. So I'm kind of encouraging people. That's the latest book I've written. But everything about me is on my website. It's johnsrennie.com. All my social links are there, my links to my books and my podcast, which is called Deep Leadership. And similar to you, I bring on leadership experts, people that are leading companies, entrepreneurs, military leaders, community leaders, and we learn from their experiences. So that's what we do on Deep Leadership.
Well, my brother, I am one, thankful for your service. I'm thankful that you didn't hide your gift and not share it with the world. You know, I have a funny feeling, hopefully at some point in my life, maybe not here in another life, we can all sit at the table and shoot the shit one day. But, you know, I envision surrounding myself with people like you or like-minded and probably just as nutty as I am when it comes to things like this. So I applaud you for that and recognize you for that. So I appreciate your time, man. And thanks for being here.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. Thank you.
Hey guys, don't forget to check out the Street Cop Training Conference 2023, April 23rd through the 28th, Nashville, Tennessee, the Gaylord at Opry. What a center, what a place. We have amazing speakers, amazing training, five of the most impactful days of your career. Check it out at StreetCop.com. You do not want to miss out. There is a room code available for a discounted room. Sign up now at StreetCop.com.